Morning, welcome back. So lovely to see everybody, and I apologize for the technical detail difficulties in getting in today, but let us learn. In the meantime, we are about to begin our annual tradition right now, which is Seder in the Seder, putting Seder into one Seder, and what we try to do is every year, we look at a number of ideas together over the course of the week before Pesach and try to put some perspective into the Seder itself. So I'd like to start off this week by thanking Karen and Michael Rosenblum, who are here in the Zoom room, who are joining us for the shiur today, who are sponsoring in honor of the yahrzeit of Karen's beloved father, Mr. Julius Sand Yehuda Ben Meir. Olav HaShalom, I believe it is the second yahrzeit now that we are approaching. It should be the fourth, I can't even believe it. The fourth yahrzeit, which is going to be, which is today, Bo Bayom. It should be an Aliyas Neshama for him, and Mitz Hashem, we should hear Besoros Tovas in the family and in Klal Yisrael, Bekarov, soon, God willing.
Rabbi, I'll sponsor for continued for Shlema, for Zev Melech Ben Bedina, and all others that need a Refor Shlema.
As for Refor Shlema, for Zev Melech Ben Bedina, and all others, Be'ezras Hashem, who are in need of a Refor Shlema. Thank you. Thank you, David. So let us get learning. Metz Hashem. I'm going to share a screen of our notes for this morning, and I did send it out as a PDF to the share group, but nonetheless, let us do this together. Here we go. Okay. Here we go. Okay. So I'm going to share our notes and let us learn. So here we have it, folks. Here we have it. Seder in your Seder 5-7 is 5780. So we're going to look at a few ideas today, and we're going to look at a few different Haggadahs which reflect this. So Haggadah number one is actually going to be today is redemption. Then and now, this is the Haggadah of Rabbi Benjamin Blech, who should live and be well, who was just in our shul earlier this year. He said a very beautiful insight. And he talks about, you know, in the Haggadah, we're very into numbers. And in fact, so much so, at the end of the Haggadah, we get to sing this very special song, where who knows one, who knows two, who knows three, we go all the way up to the number 13. But it is a little bit sad because it ends prematurely. What about the number 15? Who knows the number 15? 15 is an important number when it comes to the Haggadah for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is because 15 is a very important number in the Haggadah. It is the 15 steps, in fact, of Kadesh or Chatz. It is the 15 steps of the Seder itself. In a certain sense, it's the framework of the entire Seder as a whole, which allows us the framework of reference. It's interesting that in the Hebrew numbering system, when you look at the number 15, it doesn't follow the regular permutation, in the sense that, usually speaking, when you have a number in Hebrew and the notation, let's say when we get into the teens, so when you get to 11, it's Yud Aleph, that's 10 and 1. Then when it gets to 12, it's Yud Beis, that's 1 and 2. Then Yud Gimel, Yud Dalet, and then when you get to number 15, you would expect at that point in time for it to be Yud and then Hey, and it's not. It's Tes Vav, which is 9 and 6. Now, yes, 9 and 6 do certainly add up to 15, but we somehow move away from using the Tes Vav as the number 15. Why is that? One of the reasons that is because, in fact, the number 15 itself is the name of Hashem. The name of Hashem is Yud and Hey. That's one aspect of the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's in the beginning of the Shema Vaya, and it's his name in and of its own right. Givako Hashem Tzur Olamim, that Hashem created the world with those two letters, the Yud and the Hey. It represents, so to speak, the two dimensions, the spiritual dimension and the physical dimension. And what is fascinating about this is, in a certain sense, the Seder is the framework of seeing HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. It also happens to be that the date of the Seder itself is the night of the 15th. So we're really seeing the convergence of these ideas. When you move up towards the Ezras Yisrael, when you move towards the area in the Beis HaMikdash, where you get close to the Kedusha, as you enter that level, you walk up 15 stairs again, the Shir HaMa'alos, the 15 Shir HaMa'alos, as we move closer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why is that so pertinent? Why is that so relevant? So the truth is that there is this name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a certain place in the Torah where it's used. The place where we find it is to be found at the end of Parshas Beshalach, where there is an episode of the War of Amalek. At the end of this whole war, Yeshua fights the nation of Amalek. Moshe Rabbeinu is up on the mountain, and everybody's fighting on all fronts. So we are told the following: Vayomer ki yad al keisko milchama la Hashem Amalek midar dar. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu has this entire war with Amalek intergenerationally, because it's almost like their hand is upon the throne of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak. What does that mean exactly? Rashi tells us there's a little bit of a idiosyncrasy when it comes to reading the pasuk. The pasuk says, Yodai shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu hurma leshaveya bekisoi. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu's hand, so to speak, is lifted to make an oath on his throne. Liyos lo milchama ve'eva b'amalek olamos. That he has an eternal hate, so to speak, an eternal dislike for Amalek for all time. Umau case v'lo ne'mar kiseh. Now, generally speaking, the word for throne in Hebrew is kiseh. The word for a chair is a kiseh. Why is it that in this pasuk it's framed as the word case, not kiseh? V'av Hashem nechlach ilechetzio. And the name of Hashem is split down the middle. So it's not yud hey and then a vav and then a hey, but rather it's yud and then hey. Nishba HaKadosh Baruch Hu she'en shmoy shalom ve'en kisoy shalom ad shimoche shmoy shalom alek kuloy. HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes an oath that Amalek is that his throne and his name is not complete in this world as long as there is an Amalek in the world. Therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is saying, name ka, yud and then a hey, is an expression of there being something still missing in this world, which is why as much as it is a revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's the same time it is also the diminution of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this world, which brings us to a very fascinating insight of the Beis HaLevi, Rav Soloveitchik. Very, very beautiful insight that he points out. He says, you know, it's interesting that when Bnei Yisrael were saved from Egypt, they were saved halfway through the experience. Here's what he says in his Pirush on Parshas Boy. He says the following: Va'inyan, we should know, Dikvar kosavnu alha deloy hayu b'Mitzrayim rak redu shana. They were only in Egypt for 210 years. Degoalom be'emtza hazman, that he redeemed them at the middle of the time. Va'azman shechosar oz hiniach HaKadosh Baruch Hu shiashlimu oiso Yisrael l'soif begolus ha'achron. That in the end of the day, HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, you're going to pay back that time which you have on credit, so to speak, at the end of Exodus, at the end of time. The Yetzias Mitzrayim ha'irak bepekida beemtza hazman v'ya hachana leguula asida kadei sheyuchlu liyigoel achakach keyashiyashlimu hazman. What's going to happen is at the end of time, you're going to now be able to find the full redemption. Which means that the redemption of Egypt was early. Yes, it was a good thing, but at the same time, we still owe back the balance of the 190 years, so to speak, whether that be numerically or whether it be in terms of quantitatively or qualitatively, we need to pay back that zgolus. He says, and if you look around, a number of the Sifrei HaDrush talk about this. And therefore, he says, Lefize nimsa de ikar ha'avchona. Shehaya bevris ben abasarim shigalem lesoy besoyf azman kumosha amar kol shbarachu avachre ken yetsi berchush gadol loynis kaim adayin. That means to say that the end of the bris ben abasarim, the covenant between the parts between the Almighty and Abraham, has not yet been fulfilled. We've not yet got the ruchush gadol fully. Why? Okay, she yushlam azman. It'll only be finished when we finish that time. Vezel shama bemedrash echa hashvii hispiani bemromim. Hirvani la'ano, ma she's bi'ani bamromim belele Pesach, hirvani la'ano belel Tisha B'Av. That the Medrash says that Tisha B'Av, in a certain sense, is the completion of the night of Pesach, based on the Pasuk in Eicha. What wasn't fixed in the night of Pesach, the incomplete redemption, is going to be seen in the completion of that exile on the night of Tisha B'Av. Delel Tisha B'Av lo'olam chal belel shechal boy Pesach. However, we know that there's a rule in the numeric calendar that we have with when it comes to Tisha B'Av and Pesach. It's called the Atbash system. That Pesach maps out the rest of the days of the year for all other festivals. Atbash is that that the Aleph, the first day of Pesach, is parallel to the Taf, the Tisha B'Av, the Beis, right? So each of the second day of Pesach is going to be against the next day in the calendar. The day of Tisha B'Av will always be the same day as the first day of Pesach, which means that this year, God willing, Tisha B'Av will be on a Wednesday night going into a Thursday, just because that's the way the calendar is set up. Tisha B'Av is integrally related and linked to Pesach. That's just not just in the calendar, but that's also ideologically the Beis Halevi is telling us. Ulu kavona zu, da yedei she geulas Pesach hoya be'emtza hazman, v'utzruchu lahashlim cheshbon ha'golos achar v'yotzu mizeh leil Tisha B'Av. So in a certain sense, the first half of the night is Pesach, the second half of the night is Tisha B'Av, and those two come together, which I think is what Rabbi Blech was saying, is that the Seder is Tesvav. It is on the 15th of the month. It is the 15 steps because it relates to the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is right now somewhat incomplete. The name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not fully there. We don't have full access to it. Why? For a very simple reason, is because we are still in the throes of there being evil in the world. We're still in the throes of there being negativity. We're still suffering many, many slings and barbs of Golus, and therefore we still remember that this our Golus is still incomplete, and hopefully we are going to reach the completion and see the day, which is fully day. We get to the end of those years of Golus and see the Rechush Gadol and return to Eretz Israel like the promise of Avraham Avinu. That's idea number one. Let's move on to our second idea. I think this is a fascinating idea. For this, we move into a different Agada. This is Agada called the Historical Agada by Rabbi Nachman Cohen. Really fascinating individual. And he says, I just such a fascinating suggestion, such a fascinating insight. Here's what he talks about. He talks about the Greek paradox of change. The Greeks had a little bit of an issue, and that there are many issues, but one of the issues they had is that their physics was informed by their philosophy. So therefore, before actually experimentation, they did more philosophizing about it. And they had a problem with the notion of change. Well, not all Greeks, but many of the philosophers did. And the issues, they believed that change was illusory. And that's why, according to many Aristotelian physics, they believed the world was kadmon, that the world was just always was. There was never a moment of start. There was never a moment of initiation. There was no such thing as creation ex nihilo. That's why the Rambam, who very much firmly adopts much of Aristotelian philosophy, completely rejects this element of it, which is kfirah, which is denial of the Almighty. The Rambam spends an inordinate amount of time in Moreh Nevuchim disproving this notion. But it's fascinating just to look in for a second some of the Greek paradoxes about change and understand one key element to the Agada based on this. Here's an example of the paradoxes suggested by a philosopher by the name of Zeno. Here's the paradox of distance. Just fascinating thinking about this. He says the following. It is logically impossible for an object or a person to traverse from point A to point B in a finite amount of time because there are an infinite number of dimensions, mathematical points between A and B, and an infinite number of points cannot be traversed in a finite amount of time. Fascinating. Now, we know that to be true because we know that between point A and point B on any ruler, on any space line, between any points, is divisible infinitely, meaning to say I can always carry on infinitely dividing that amount of space. So therefore, if there exists an infinite amount of space, how in a finite amount of time can I cover an infinite amount of distance? That's the question that he presents. It's a paradox of distance. How can we ever travel? He has another paradox. It's called the paradox of motion. Examine an arrow in flight. Break the trajectory down into smaller and smaller units. Reduce the interval to time frame of a snapshot. The arrow is standing still. But if it is standing still, how could it also be moving? This proves that motion is illusory. It should be noted the subject of the paradox is debated by the rabbis, and Rikiva also talks about klutu kamishu hunchu adavi. Right, so this is a whole discussion as to whether you can say something which is munach in the airspace of somebody else for another time. And then the paradox of space. To exist, an object must be confined within a physical area. The room I'm sitting in, and he describes where he's sitting in doing his work in the Bronx in New York, and he talks about how it is part of a much bigger space. So here's the example he gives. The room I'm sitting in is within my office. This is within my home, which is in my street in Yonkers, which is in New York State, which is in the United States of America, which is in North America, which is on Earth, which is in our solar system, which is in the Orion arm of the Milky Way galaxy, which is in the Virgo supercluster, which is in the visible universe. But within what is the universe contained? Since we are faced with an infinite regress, that is, everything must be contained within something else, and since there cannot be a last item with which can exist without being contained, this proves that space is but an illusion. So these are the types of paradoxes. Yes, Zeno would have been a very difficult person to have coffee with. You know, like, you want to just talk about the news, and here's Zeno talking about, do I really exist in space? But nonetheless, this is one line within Greek philosophy. So the argument that Rabbi Cohen makes, I think, is a very beautiful insight into the Haggadah. He says the rabbinic response. What's the response of the Haggadah to this? The Haggadah is not just talking about history. The Haggadah is talking about our theology. This is the rabbi's response to this paradox of Zeno. Their response consists of calling Hashem Hamakom, the place. By this is meant that the world is encapsulated within God and not that God is encapsulated within the world. It was God who created space. Only physical entities require space and for existence. God, the creator of space and time, does not. The response was important. The fallacy of the Greeks was everything had a physical component. The pro-Socrates did not accept the notion of total spiritual being. The use of Hamakom serves to emphasize that God, you know, that the Greek scope of the universe is incomplete and insufficient. And so therefore the answer to Zeno's questions are, yes, you're correct. It is a paradox. That's if you're only working within the span of physicality. But we have a little bit more of a dimension than that. And therefore, going back to his third paradox, the idea that that ultimately the paradox of space, the context of all space is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the glue behind which and is the power behind which everything else exists. When we talk about Baruch HaMokom Baruch Hu, Baruch Shana San Torah Lamo Yisrael, we have to understand that we don't just view history as a discrete amount of events which are connected together and strung together in one timeline. We're viewing it as the idea that there is an inner line, an inner string which holds together all the beads of all of history, and that's called HaMokom. That's the context of all reality, and that's how we move from place B A to place B. That's how we, every moment you take a look at a snapshot of Israel, yes, they're moving and yes, they're not moving, but what connects the cohesive timeline and time frame of all Jewish existence is HaMakom. Therefore, as we're about to start the Maggid, we say, Baruch HaMakom, Baruch Hu, Baruch Shana San Torah Lamo Yisrael. And therefore, that's the notion of this. I would like to take it one step further because I think this is not just the idea that the HaMakom is used over here, and not only is this the time that HaMakom is used in our lives is the times of great joy and great sorrow, where we know HaMakom arrives. Also the time when a person comforts the sick, we use the name of HaMakom as well. It's not just at those moments we recognize there's a spiritual entity in this world, but it's also the framework of the entire Haggadah. Now let me explain why. This is the Haggadah of the Netziv, the Imre Shefer, very, very beautiful. Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin of Volozhin, the Rosh Shiva of the Yeshiva in Volozhin. It's a very, very beautiful insight, and it helps us shed light on Dayenu. He takes the same idea as what Rabbi Cohen was doing, but he takes it one step further. And this is what he explains, perhaps to me, is one of the more perplexing parts of the Seder, which is the idea of Dayenu. Yes, I understand, and we love singing Dayenu, and it's a highlight for the kids, and we can get them through just to get to the beginning of Shulchan Aruch with Dayenu. But in the end of the day, why is it so critical? Why do we need Dayenu? So he says a very beautiful insight, and this is how he explains it. He says, Elu, ha'asov Elohim shvatim v'lo yaragas v'chareim, v'ozeh ho'esiv laharos lanu, this is in source 5, Al Baal Bechira. Shunidrash Lashkochi Yasera, Kamavuar Bezar HaKadosh. So he says the following. He says that this teaches us the extra added level of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's endurance, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's investment in this world. It looks to me like I actually put the incorrect citation over here into the source sheet. So I'm going to take it back to one level in the actual Haggadah itself. Here's what he says. He says, he carries on teaching us all the incredible amount of goodness that he did for us. At the beginning, why is it that in our Seder we use the word HaMakom? Did you notice at the beginning of Dayenu, it says, again the name HaMakom appears. Why is that the name that's chosen for HaKadosh Baruch Hu when enumerating all the good things that he did? Who cares that HaKadosh Baruch Hu destroyed the Egyptian gods on the way out? That their firstborns were killed. And we got their money. Was that so critical? Let's say those things were absent. Would that have changed our national history and our culture? Would that have changed our destiny as the nation of Israel? Not really. It's very nice, but it didn't necessarily change the destiny. This is what we're going to call a tova. He says, Elo, here's his suggestion. What a powerful idea. He says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going out of his way to show us Hashkocha Pratis, that he has divine, specific providence. He's going to do every detail, even what may seem the unnecessary details. That's what it means when we say HaKadosh Baruch Hu is place. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the context of all reality. Because of his hashkacha, his providence, which means when we're singing Dayenu, we're not saying HaKadosh Baruch Hu, were it not for these 15 things, coming back to the 15 again in the Dayenu, were it not for these 15 things, we would not exist. No. Actually, you could knock a few of them off and it would still be fine. But when we enumerate them, we're enumerating the fact that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was with us. We know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was side by side with us. We could feel His presence in life. That's what's being expressed in Dayenu. That's why the word Hamakom is used. And that's specifically the response to the Greeks who don't believe that there is any spiritual dimension in life. And therefore they continue haphazardly being drifting down the river of Mikre, of happenstance. There are no way, no ability of connecting those dots as we do. We connect the dots of the night of the Seder, and that's why we turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as HaMakom. What a powerful, powerful idea. Let's move on to the idea of Hashem and the Malach, Hashem and the angel. I saw a very fascinating idea that HaKadosh Baruch Hu describes, or the Haggadah describes, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu came to save us in the night of Pesach. It says, Ani v'loy Malach. Hashem says, I was the one who saved you in Mitzrayim, and not a Malach. Why not? Why is this such a critical issue to relate to on the night of the Seder? So the Shem Mishmuel, Rav Shmuel Bornstein explains a very beautiful insight. He says, Lo yadayar malach, ani hu v'lo yacher, upirush maharal. He says, El acher shuhu sam. He refers to the who's the acher. What's the other entity that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is precluding from being here? Is Samoel. Samoel is another word for the Satan. Ukvar diktaknu, lelefim ha-shakosu v'ari. Betam ani v'lay malach. He quotes the Arizal, who says, "What does it mean ani v'lay malach? Sha'afilu malach haya niskashem beridatoy b'mitzrayim." Egypt was so physical that any angel would have to transform into the outer experience of physicality to enter into Mitzrayim. That's how deep and depraved it was. Ad kan. So to speak, HaKadosh Baruch Hu needed to enter without any barriers, because it had to be pure spirituality which entered, because even an angel would not be able to enter. Chen mashma b'medrash. V'im kein, yesh lahavin, lama lahosa hamaka al yedei, sitra achra shel acher. V'nire dihine maka al yedei ha-sitra achra, hu kumoi eres ha-mechalchel v'yareid. He says, look, whenever you have, let's say HaKadosh Baruch Hu allowed the facilitation of this last Makkah to be Al Yadei, the Sitra Achra, this other side, the dark side, then whenever you have that, it's like a poison which enters the entire body. Devlad trefa benis abra ulevasof nitrefa asur dihi vevlada nitrefa. So this is a halacha that let's say I have a animal which is a trefa. That means to say that it is mortally ill. It has one of the of a number of different signs which indicates that it is on the process in the process of death. So in such a case, if that animal gives birth to a calf, if it calves, that calf is considered a trefa as well. In other words, we consider there to be if you have a illness, we consider it to be hereditary. And even the child is reflecting that disease. V'alkein, ba'asher Yisrael, ho'yu oz, ku'ubar b'mei imoy, imoy so oz, chola amako amitzrayim, mako misitra achro, ho'yso meziko, behecherech gam li Yisrael. Israel was so dependent on Egypt. Israel was like that fetus in the mother's tummy, in the mother's womb, that should HaKadosh Baruch Hu allow forces of evil to actually hurt Israel, or hurt Egypt, Egypt is the mother, is the carrier. Even Israel would have been impacted so much so. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself needed to do the surgery so carefully that only the Egyptians would be hurt and not Israel at this critical moment in time. Just to think about that from a perspective, you know, it sounds far out, but it's not so far out. Sometimes we should ask ourselves, and we should ask all Jews throughout Jewish history, you know, who are you? How American are you, and how Jewish are you? How French are you? How Jewish are you? How English are you? How Jewish are you? How Spanish are you? How Jewish are you? We have to ask these questions. And a lot of times I think that if we're really intellectually honest, sometimes that's a very difficult question to answer. You know, like sometimes people have this experience where, you know, when Russian jury finally came through and people sort of looked at them a little bit differently. Even though, yes, we fought to break down the Iron Curtain and bring them across, and yes, but they're like a little different, right? They're not us. Why? Because us is informed by the mother culture that we're in. We're Americans, we're Canadians, we're sophisticated, we're Westerners. They haven't quite got up to that point in time, and it took a little while. So, but that dichotomy is a function of the fact that one's culture, one's mother culture, is more informative to one about who one is than necessarily we'll call it the common framework, which is Judaism itself. That's something which is worthwhile thinking about. In World War II, at the end of World War II, there were packets which were given to American soldiers to describe dealing with the French. Because although they're our allies, they operate differently. One of the items in that pamphlet at the end of World War II was, they shower less than us. So therefore, don't be offended by their smell. That was one of the things the American army was distributing at the end of World War II. Culture is a very important factor when it comes to our operation. And what the Haggadah is saying is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu realized that. He realized that the nation of Israel was so embedded in Egypt that their culture was so much Egyptian at this point in time that suffering and impact on the Egyptian culture would automatically trickle down into their own entity and their emotional makeup. HaKadosh Baruch Hu therefore had to do it so surgically carefully that only the Jews were impacted and Israel could actually come out unaffected. That's a very powerful insight that the Shem Yishmael is saying, Kabbalistically and also emotionally. Let's move a little further. And this is a very interesting insight. We're now going to move into the Haggadah called the Royal Table. This is Rabbi Norman Lamb, should live and be well's Haggadah. He says a very fascinating insight, and this is about HaSeder. When we get a little bit later into the Seder and we start doing the Mitzvot HaLaila, we know that there's a number of Mitzvot which require leaning. Why do we lean? It's interesting that the place that we look for the leaning is the Gemara itself. The Gemara talks about why we do the leaning, and he says a very beautiful insight. He says, look, we lean on the left side when we drink the four cups and eat the matzah according to the Talmud because of the hygienic reason, not to choke on our food. But beyond that, the scholars suggest other dimensions. The leaning is a symbol of aristocracy and freedom. But this is puzzling. Now, we read the Gemara, we see that Gemara in Pesachim, we understand and we talk about freedom and the expression of leadership, of being kingly. At the same time, he says, but this is puzzling. Why adopt our Jewish religious purposes a form of posture that was unique to Romans of 2,000 years ago? Think about this. When the Gemara was talking about this, the Gemara is reflecting, when you look at those pictures and those inscriptions of the Romans, and they're lying on their couches in a circle, that was a practice of the Jews at the time. Why? As a function of what the Roman norms were. Why do we adopt those norms as being the norms of expressions of kingliness, of aristocracy? The answer, I suggest, lies in an irony. Why is our Seder lacking and incomplete today? Why do we not observe the Passover sacrifice, which was the center of the Seder in the days of independence? Why are we today in exile? It is because of the Romans 2,000 years ago destroyed our temple. But we shall not allow the destruction to rob us of the authenticity and undo us as a people. And so today, we practice the very Roman symbol of freedom, the inclining on the left side. We adopt the Roman posture of leisure and thereby celebrate Zecher LeMikdash, remembering everything that occurred in the temple while they, the Romans, who ravaged the temple, are no longer in existence. Something so simple to notice. That Gemara is talking about a Roman norm, but we adopt that Roman norm specifically to show that the Romans right now, think about Hashem Yishmor, Italy right now. That's all that's left of Rome, and unfortunately, at this point in time, even more than ever before. Where is the nation of Israel? They're still leaning on their left. It's still like Chazal, the time of the Romans are still adopting that expression of leisure from the time of Galus to as an expression of the idea of aristocracy and of freedom, says Rabbi Norman Lamb. Very powerful idea. As we lean at the Leil HaSeder, we have a lot to be thankful for in terms of our own freedom, in terms of the freedom from the Golus, which we hope that will end soon. And finally, one last point, and we'll try to close with this today as we move towards our Seder, and that is, to me, one of the most fascinating ideas, and that is the idea of the Beis HaLevi once again. This relates to a particular episode in the Seder, one of my favorite parts of the Seder altogether, and that is the story about Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Tafon Shem Mesub ben Bnei Brak. Today it's not so easy to be Mesub ben Bnei Brak, unfortunately. Bnei Brak is under quarantine. But in, going back into this Leil HaSeder, the one night of the Seder that the Haggadah references of, so to speak, doing what it's telling us to do, is this particular Seder, this Leil HaSeder. Until the students arrived and said, "Rabbi Seno, Rabbi, it's Shachris time. It's time we need to move on." So this is the famous Seder in history. What's a little bit strange is the following: is the next step in the Haggadah is the following. Amar Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, she quote, this is a Mishnah in Brachos. Harei ani kiven shivim shana v'lo zechis she'tema yitzias Mitzrayim ba'alelos ad shedrasha ben zoma. So Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah says, I didn't have the schus to say that we should do Yitzias Mitzrayim at night. Do Zechiras Yitzias Mitzrayim. Shenemar lamantis kroz yom says chom eretz Mitzrayim kol yimei chayachav. Because the pasuk says you should remember that the Ben Zoma made the following diok. It says in order that you should remember the day you left Mitzrayim, all the days of your life, yimei chayecha yomim kol yimei chayecha leilos. The day of your lives refers to the days. Kol yimei chayecha includes the nights. That's the drasha that Ben Zoma made, which allowed Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah to present his case, which was that we should say Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim at night. But the Chachamim disagreed, and they said, no, Yimei Chayecha refers to Olam Hazeh, Kol Yimei Chayecha refers to Laviyin Yomas Mashiach, the times of Mashiach. We'll still mention Yetzias Mitzrayim, even though we'll have had a messianic redemption at that point in time. So this is the Mishnah. There are a lot of questions to be had in this section of the Haggadah. And first of all, why specifically this Seder is being mentioned? Why is this so critical? Number two is this second paragraph here is strange because it's not talking about something we do on the night of the Seder at all. In fact, if you just want to understand this in a greater context, there are two separate mitzvahs here. The one is what's called the mitzvah of Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, of mentioning, of remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim, and then there is Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. There's telling the story of Egypt. Now, they may sound similar, but they're actually different. They have different time frames and expressions. So, for instance, Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim, the first of those, is a mitzvah we do every single day. When we say Kriya Shema in the morning, the reason why we have the third paragraph in Kriya Shema is precisely that. The mitzvah tzitzis relates to the symbol of freedom, as the Sefer HaChinuch points out. And it's because we need to mention that last pasuk, Ani Hashem, that I share Sesi Eschem in Yisrael, Yisrael Echem Ra'al Elokim, that Gosh Baruch Hu takes us out of Egypt. That's how we mention that, which means by saying that, we fulfill the mitzvah of remembering Olman Tizkroiz Yom Sesecha Meretz Yisrael Kol Yimecha Yecho. Every day of my life, I'm remembering that. According to Ben Zoma and according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, we need to do that at night, which is why we mentioned the third paragraph of Kriya Shema at night as well. Even though we're not kissing the tzitzis at that point in time, we need to do it in the morning and the evening. That is Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. Do you notice? We don't go into a whole drasha. There's no soliloquies. It's not very complicated. There's no questions and answers. It's very simply, I'm stating the fact. HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you redeemed us from Egypt. Thank you very much. That's what Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim is. Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is what is about to be this Wednesday night on Tesvav of Nisan, where we all sit down with the family, even though it may be a smaller seder than usual. We're going to sit down, we're going to ask questions and answers, we're going to maske b'gnus, we're going to call a marbel esaper. We have all these incredible halachas about Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, right? That's specifically one, or perhaps in chutzlar, it's two nights a year, we have the mitzvah Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim, which is what we're about to engage in. Now, if you put these two paragraphs back to back, therefore they don't fit well, because paragraph number one was the paragraph of the Seder. That's Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim. When you come back to the second paragraph, that's Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. That's a mitzvah which refers to every single day of the year. So why is that even making its way into the Haggadah? That's a halacha when it comes to Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's nothing to do with Pesach per se. Why is it even making its way to the Haggadah? Moreover, another question we can ask about the second paragraph is very strange. Listen, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah clearly believes that one should be saying Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim at nights as well. That's what he's saying, right? But he says, but I needed Ben Zoma to make the drasha so I could prove to the Chachamim that you should do it at nights. But wait a second. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, if you believe that it should be done at nights, you obviously have a reason you believe in that. If there's a reason you believe in that, then tell us. Tell us what the reason is. Don't wait for Ben Zoma. Just tell us what your logic is. If you believe in the same drasha as him, make the drasha. If you don't have the drasha as him, tell us your reason. But why Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, lo zochis yishetema yetzias Mitzrayim balelos ad shedrasha Ben Zoma? What's that got to do with anything? Why is Ben Zoma part of the picture? Tell us what you believe. There are a number of questions that we could ask on this in this section. So the Beis Halevi says a very, very powerful insight, extremely powerful insight into into these two paragraphs, and they're fitting into the Leil HaSeder. Such an incredible insight. Here's what he points out. The Beis Halevi points out that in fact there's another Gemara in Brachos and Daf Tes. The Gemara on Daf Tes has a machlokes about when, in fact, the Pesach is eaten is eaten when the magid can be done. Here we go. Let's take a look at source 9. The bracha, the Gemara says like this. Tanya, you're supposed to eat the meat of the Pesach on this night. Now, bear in mind the names. Rebbe Elazar ben Azaria Omer Nemar Kan Balayla Hazeh VeNemar LaHalon Right Vayti Beretz Mitzrayim Balayla Hazeh. It says that you should eat the meat on this night, and it says that I went through Egypt on this night. Malahalon Ad Chatzos is surely when HaKadosh Baruch Hu went through Egypt was until midnight. Avkan Ad Chatzos, therefore the eating the meat can only be until midnight. Omar Le Rebbe Akiva also sounds familiar. Also in that seder says VaAloi Kvar Nemar BeChipazon Ad Shas Chipazon. It was until the time of the rash. When was the chibah? That is when they could eat it. Imken ma Talmud loyma balayla yochul yehi nechal kikotchim kayom bayom Talmud loyma balayla ayon nechal v'lo bayom. So Rabbi Akiva says, no. Really, it is. It's the whole night until the time of chipazon. The Gemara clarifies this point. It says v'hani t'nai kahani t'nai. There's this machlokes is parallel to another machlokes, as it says Tanya. He says Tizbach es a Pesach bo erev kavoy Hashemesh moed says chamim Mitzrayim Rebbe Elazar omer be erev ato zoyvech u kavoy Hashemesh ato oichel u moed says chamim Mitzrayim ato tisorev Rebbe Yeshua omer be erev ato zoyvech kavoy Hashemesh ato oichel vad mosa ato oichel v'holech ad moed says chamim Mitzrayim. Let's skip this for just a moment. Omer Rebbe Abba hakol moedim kishenigol Yisrael Mitzrayim lo nigolu el ba erev. Every degree is that the geula happens in the evening, in the night. Shenema vaytziacha Hashem alakecha Mitzrayim lala. Hashem took you out at night. Ukeshiyatzu lo yatzu el ba'yom. But they actually only exited Egypt when they left in the day. Shenema mimacharas haPesach yatzu bnei Yisrael biyad b'ramah. That's when Israel left in the day. Adma nechluk. What's the argument? Ad shas chipazon. On the time of the rash, Rabbi Elazar ben Azaria sovar my chipazon chipazon to Mitzrayim. Rabbi Kiva sovar my chipazon chipazon to Yisrael. Let's get what they agree with. Let's get what they disagree with. They all agree, physically speaking, that the Egyptians were ready to reject the nation of Israel in the middle of the night. Pharaoh was in his pajamas in the middle of the night, running to find Moshe Rabbeinu to tell him to leave. We know that. That was the chipazon of Mitzrayim. That was the behala, the confusion, the chaos, the crisis of Egypt that occurred in the middle of the night. We also all agree that, physically speaking, Israel did not leave in that night. They only left the next morning, not like bandits in the middle of the night. They left as regally as possible the next morning with the permission slip of Egypt, fully in daylight time for everybody to see. That we agree. The question is like this. Is the Korban Pesach eaten to the point of the chipazon of Mitzrayim or the point of the chipazon of Yisrael? Meaning, is the Pesach eaten at Chatzos or is the Pesach eaten until daybreak? That's the machloikas of Rebbe Elazar ben Azaria. Rebbe Elazar ben Azaria and Rebbe Akiva. Rebbe Elazar ben Azaria says it's only until Chatzos, and Rebbe Akiva says until daybreak, until morning. Fascinating. So now, let's just appreciate this for a moment. This is a major machloikas, and you know the reason why it's always noted that we should try to finish the main part of the Seder before Chatzos is in deference to the opinion of Rebbe Elazar ben Azaria. That's why it is. That's where it comes from, this Gemara, based on this practice. Now let's appreciate this for a second. We know that the mitzvah of Magid, of telling of Sipur Yisrael Mitzrayim, is in fact related to Bashar Sheitei Matzah Moro Munachim Lefonecha, the time that we have the actual elements we're talking about in front of us. Which means, not only is there a machlokes in how long one can eat the meat of the Korban Pesach, there's also a machlokes as to when Magid consequently will follow and how long that will go until. Does it go until Chatzos, like we see, or does it go until daybreak? Now, let's come back and reassess the Seder that we're talking about in that historical Seder for a moment. Who is the leader of this Seder? There are five Rabbanim in Bnei Brak. Who is the leader of the Seder? Well, we know from the Gemara, actually, that we can work out very clearly who the leader is, not by who's first and not by who's last. It's not climatic or anticlimactic, but rather by the way they seat themselves. And in fact, we know that the Gemara tells us that always, like the Sanhedrin itself, would always be sat in, so to speak, a semicircle, with the most important individual being in the center. We know this because when they were to ask questions of the Sanhedrin, what they would do is they would start poschim min atzad. They would ask from the side, which means they would ask the most junior of the Sanhedrin first, because they would be scared to answer in front of the most senior, who would be in the center. So we look at this list of five. Let's take a look. Who is in the center of this Seder? Who is the leader of the Seder? Well, we have five Rabbanim, so it's the third one who's going to be in the center. Ma'aser Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yoshua, who's the third one? Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is the one who's in the center now, which, by the way, helps us distinguish isolate which year the Seder took place in as well. Because we know that there were, at this point in time, the leader of the generation was a person by the name of Rabban Gamliel, of Hillel descent, Davidic blood in his veins, and he was the leader of the generation. But he had a number of differences with one of his students, Rabbi Yoshua. And in fact, on three different occasions in the Gemara and the Mishnah, Rabban Gamliel, in fact, disagreed with Rabbi Yoshua so vociferously that he insulted him. He made him do terrible things to disprove his opinion. And he did that for a very important reason, because there was no space for dissent. When you're overruled in halachic reality, you don't exist as a footnote. That doesn't work that way. But nonetheless, he was very strong about the way that he did it. So one example the Gemara in Brachos gives is that there was a difference in calculation of when the new month would be. And it was the month of Tishrei, so it would impact when Yom Kippur was. So Rabban Gamliel forced Rabbi Yoshua to come with his money belt and his staff on Yom Kippur to him. You know, it was to disprove the Yom Kippur date that Yeshua believed was true. Rabban Gamliel said, "You have to know, I'm the Nasim, this is going to be how it is, and you're going to listen to that. There's not going to be any differences. You're not going to create sectarian groups about this." There, at a certain point, the rabbis felt that Rabban Gamliel's treatment of Yeshua was too harsh, and in fact, they deposed of him. They deceited Rabban Gamliel as the leader of the generation. At that point in time, the Gemara describes that they were searching for a replacement. They said, "Who should replace him?" They said, "Rabbi Yeshua, not Rabbi Yeshua. He's too close related to us. Rabbi Akiva, different types of yichus." And finally, they said, "You know what we should do? We should turn to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah." The problem was he was a very young man. He was 18 years old at the time. He went to consult with his wife. He first a very important rule in general. And finally he accepted it. He accepted the nesios. He accepted this position of the leadership. And that's when he says, "Arei ani kaven shivim shana. I'm like 70 years old," because he was given that nesios at such an early age, at such a young age. So therefore, by the way, afterwards the Gemara describes how Rabban Gamliel came back, and in fact they alternated their leadership. Now, if Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is at the center of the Seder, we know that it was this year, this critical year, where there was a lot of argument. There was a lot of argument in Klal Yisrael. Rabbi Yeshua, Rabban Gamliel, Rabban Gamliel deposed at this point in time, he's going to be brought back, but Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah at this point in time is the leader of the Seder, which indicates we know exactly specifically which year this is, and the critical nature of this. In fact, there's a Tosefta which describes that Rabban Gamliel was making a Seder in Lod. And we can say that was the parallel Seder where Rabban Gamliel was alone that year, because he was not the leader that particular year, which we can isolate. Now, it goes one step further. If Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is the leader of the Seder, then we know something very important. And that is what is his opinion as to when the Pesach can be eaten, and hence when we can do Sippur Yetzias Mitzrayim until? Well, we know he believes that the main point of Yetzias Mitzrayim was the Chippozon de Mitzrayim, was when the Egyptians were in chaos in the middle of the night. Which means that Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah believed that the Seder should only really go until Chatzos. He's the leader of the Seder. It's his first year as the Nasi. It's his first year as being the leader. So what should he say? He should put his foot down and say, "Everybody, that's it. We're reaching, it looks like it's 12:54 a.m. It's time to end the Seder, folks." But that's not what happens. Why? And the answer is because they were in Bnei Brak. Bnei Brak, as the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us, was the place of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva may not be the leader of the generation. He may not be the Nasi, as Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was. But nonetheless, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, in this critical year, where Machloikas was so rife, where there was so much discord, there was so much disparity in the nation of Israel, as they got to 12:54 a.m., as they were reaching their Chatzos that year, he looked the other way, and they continued, in deference to his junior in station, Rabbi Akiva, to allow the Seder to continue to the morning. This is not simply a Seder of, "Wow, look how long they went." It's a Seder of describing the peace they created to be able to do the Seder all the way through the morning, unlike his opinion. His colleague who he argued with was with him, and he deferred to him, even though he was the leader. Even though people would say in the next morning around Shul, they would say, "You know, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah didn't believe in his own opinion." No, for the sake of peace, it was worth it. That's why in the next paragraph says the Beis Halevi, when it says, "Omer Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah," the same Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, "Lo harayni kivim shivim shana, v'lo zochisi shetema yetzias Mitzrayim baleilois. I couldn't explain to my colleagues to say, Zeicher yetzias Mitzrayim, the mitzvah we do all year round, to do it at night. Why couldn't he convince them?" Because he believed, unlike Rabbi Akiva, that the main Geula, the main redemption was in the chaos of Egypt, not in the exodus of Israel the next morning. Therefore, to him, it was obvious that the primary time to say Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim would be at night. But he couldn't convince his friends because they didn't see eye to eye. They believed the primary time was the exodus when Egypt, when the nation of Israel left in the morning. Therefore, he needed the drasha ben Zoma. He needed the drasha ben Zoma to augment his position, which was his perspective of when Yetzias Mitzrayim really took place, what the critical moment of Yetzias Mitzrayim took place, which is why this second paragraph, this mission in Brachos, is included, even though it isn't necessarily germane to the subject of the idea of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim itself. Fascinating insight of the Beis Halevi. There is more to say on this, but nonetheless, owing to time, we're going to stop at this point over here. I want to thank everybody for taking the time. If I don't get to see the Chevra beforehand, I want to take an opportunity to wish everybody a Chag Kasher, a good, healthy Pesach, and Mitzvah Shema Refuah Shlema to all those who are ill, and protection for many, many more who should not become ill. Be'ezras Hashem Yisbarach.